This is Linda Leonard, 6 December 1995, Creation's Heartbeat, Following the Reindeer Spirit.
Reindeer archetype, and also some other goodies. I hope they're goodies, okay? So the way that I got to this topic was from a dream. And I'm going to preface that before I tell you the dream. My first book, The Wounded Woman, Healing the Father-Daughter Relationship, for those of you who have read it, you know that it had to do with the wound to the feminine coming from the wound to the father, both the personal father and the father in society, and the wound that passes on down to the feminine. And I wrote the book primarily to redeem my own relationship with my father, who was an alcoholic and who remained one, and who I was unable to reconcile with while he was alive. And so after he died, I then had a dream that I was to write about this. And but as often happens in the dream, I also, in the dream, it said that I knew everything I needed to know to write the book, but when I woke up, I couldn't remember a thing. So anyway, so 7 years later, I finished that book. And I thought, I expected on a conscious level that it was going to end with something like redeeming the father, and there's a chapter on that in here. But after I finished that chapter, I had a series of dreams about returning to the feminine center and how important it was. This was back in the late 70s, and how important it was to do that. And so I realized that for women in their lives, it's very important to return to the feminine center in order to live as a woman. And even for men, it's important to, because of their feminine side, it's important to know what that feminine center is all about, because they have that feminine side in themselves too, though they, of course, are going to need to live from their own center. Well, I then had a chapter called Finding Feminine Spirit, which is kind of a questing chapter. And at the time, I was asking different people for images, and I got a lot of people came up with different animal images, which I thought was very striking. This is in the late 70s. I remember one person mentioned a panther in particular, and so somehow that remained in my mind. Okay, so then I went on, and I got involved in a relationship with a man, and we took a trip to Bali to study shamanism together. And so that was a kind of an involvement with shamanism. And then he had a dream in around late 1985 and early 1986. I think it was late 1985. I had just finished On the Way to the Wedding, and we had just started Witness to the Fire, which is about my book about creativity and addiction. And so I was in the heart of that book, the Witness to the Fire book. And then he told me this dream, and this was the dream. And this dream started me off on this book, which had a different title at the time. This is the book on the reindeer. And it also went back to that last chapter around the animal image of wounded woman. So his dream was, he's a doctor. He's a psychiatrist, and he also worked as a family, in family medicine and emergency medicine, too. So in the dream, he's going to a doctor's conference on healing, and he goes into the first meeting, which is on, which is kind of like a social reception or something. And he felt that everybody was very cool and kind of isolated, and there was a loss of soul. The people were more interested in impressing each other than they were in connecting on any kind of a soul level. And he felt essentially there was a loss of soul in the room, and he wanted to leave. But he decided maybe he should stay a little bit just to make sure that he was right. So he went and he saw a white piano in the room, and he went to play the piano, because music would be for him an expression of emotion and the soul. But then when he sat down at the piano, he thought, no, this is not the atmosphere to do this. I do need to leave. And so, as often happens in a dream, he saw a door that he could exit through that he hadn't seen when he entered the room. And so he went through this door. And when he went through the door, he came into another room that was totally different. It was opened out onto a vast wilderness. And so this room had glass doors, essentially, that were all open. And the vast wilderness was a kind of a forest. And as he entered, and the wind was blowing, and as he entered, this woman ran in, and she was wearing deerskin clothing, and she had little pieces of, leaves and stuff in her hair. And she was totally real healthy and spontaneous and very beautiful in that kind of a centered, healthy, vibrant nature kind of way. And so he was amazed and totally entranced, and he asked her who she was. And the way she answered was that she said, "I've just come back from a journey. I've been running with a herd of pregnant reindeer for a month." And he woke up thinking, "I'd like to do that too. I'd like to run with a herd of pregnant reindeer." So this woman who ran with this herd of pregnant reindeer became an image for me. And I thought that it probably might be, though I didn't understand all the implications at the time, it might be an integrative image for the wounded woman. And so, but what I did was I kind of held the image, and then I continued with my book, Witness to the Fire, which took me about 3 years to write. And so I was holding this image, but all along, then my antennae, or what I've come to see, that reindeer have antlers, you know, and the females also have antlers. And I've come to see that those reindeer antlers are spiritual antennae. Well, those antennae were focused, you know, on reindeer images and anything about reindeer. So that was kind of in my psyche. And after I finished the book, I then decided to take a sabbatical in order to have the time to do the research on this book, but I didn't know what that was going to involve. So really, I'm talking a little bit here about following a dream as well, okay, because this came from a dream, which I felt was bigger than just the person who had the dream. I felt that, you know, it was a, you know, one of those archetypal dreams that Jung talks about, a big dream that would have meaning, could have meaning for many, many people. Keith and I were driving over Independence Pass in the Rockies, and that's about between 11 and 12,000, that pass. And the terrain is somewhat like the tundra. And maybe some of you here have been over it, I don't know. It goes from Aspen, and kind of between Aspen and Leadville. And just as we hit the top of the pass, a symphony came over the car radio, and it was Finlandia by Sibelius. And so, you know, tuning into synchronicities, you know, which are, from Jung's point of view, something that happens outside of us but has an inner meaning, I thought, of course, that's where reindeer are. They're up there in Finland, you know, and in Lapland. And I thought, that's what I should do. I should go to where the reindeer are, because I've never really seen a reindeer, you know, not really. And that's what we decided to do. And so in 89, we took our first trip to the Arctic to explore reindeer. And we went up first to Lapland, and which is Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Western Russia, up above the Arctic Circle. And when we got there, I learned that there was a whole group of people, which I really didn't know about before, that followed reindeer. And that reindeer were a sort of a transcendent spiritual being for these people, and that they followed them, the reindeer migrations, both on a practical level, but that they were also, that this was an animal that was a spiritual totem animal. Okay, and this is the Sami people in Lapland. They're the indigenous people in Lapland, that part of the Arctic. So that was amazing to me. I found that there was a whole culture then around reindeer. And then I also learned at that time, and I didn't know it before, that reindeer actually did go on a journey to give birth. So that the pregnant reindeer journey that was in the dream is an actuality. Reindeer leave pretty much around when the ice starts to melt, around April, mid-April something, depending on exactly where they are. And they go up north, to give birth takes them about a month, month and a half, and they go to the basically to the place where they were born themselves. And then in the fall they come back south, you know, for their winter home. So they go on this kind of a cyclical journey, and the journey is really a birthing journey. So I thought this was really amazing. You know, that here, you know, this is an animal that really does go on a journey to give birth. And then I learned that among deer, the deer family, reindeer are the animals, and also caribou, who would be their American relatives. They're the animals that have, the females also have antlers. Because in most of the deer, it's the males that have antlers, right? But in among reindeer, females also have antlers, which is really nice if you're a woman to think about having these antlers, because the antlers are very magical. And also, the antlers provide the reindeer, which is a gentle animal, a very gentle animal, provide the antlers with a way to protect themselves against predators. So that here, with this reindeer, you've got a combination of the integration. It's an image for the integration of the qualities of gentleness and of strength. Okay? And I had been finding out, and also for a long time, just from working with people, from teaching, from workshops, from my own life, and from the Wounded Woman book, I had been, and the Witness to the Fire book, which is about addiction, I had been feeling that the qualities of gentleness and receptivity and vulnerability are often denigrated in our culture. And not only are they denigrated, but they're confused with victimization and weakness. And I think that confusion then splits people into a kind of a dualism where they tend to opt either for the gentle or for the strong, probably depending on their temperament and also on, you know, various developmental factors and societal factors. And in The Wounded Woman, you might recall I had two basic patterns that I, at that time, called the Puella, and which is the Eternal Girl, and the Armored Amazon, which is the woman who has an armor of strength outside, but her vulnerability and her gentleness is inside. The Puella tends more to have the gentleness on the outside, and her own strength is often hidden inside. We're having a problem.
If you could move the microphone a little bit.
I had a feeling that. I think that's the way I have it on, maybe.
Is that? Just pull it up closer.
Yeah.
And now I can turn the volume down and make that less things. And then just kind of pull it over so that the cord is not cutting off the cable.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
Okay, is that going to work?
Yes.
Is it better? Could you hear?
That's better.
Even. Yeah, could you hear though? The previous you could hear, but this is better, right? Okay. I'm a bit of a technological retard. Anyway, let me see. I'll get my track back now. Okay, so in The Wounded Woman, these two patterns, the Eternal Girl, the one who is more likely to show the gentleness and the receptivity and either be out of contact with the strength or not be able to bring that forward is one pattern. And then the other pattern is the Armored Amazon, who shows the warrior side on the outside, and then often her gentleness and her vulnerability is on the inside, and she either doesn't even know about it but feels it through relationship difficulties, or wants to connect with it but is afraid to. Okay, so I felt that, and what I said in The Wounded Woman is that we need to bring these, it's one of the things I said, we need to bring these two qualities together in ourselves. Women do, certainly, and men do too, for that matter. So I saw then the reindeer, in a way, as a very interesting animal image for bringing these two qualities together, because the reindeer embodies both qualities. Can everybody connect with that, with that idea? So that was really, really striking to me that, you know, that there was an actual animal that that kind of was a totem animal for what I had been thinking about in The Wounded Woman. And so I then continued to research about reindeer, and I learned that, you know, as I said, that the females have antlers, which means they can protect themselves. And I also mentioned that I see those antlers as spiritual antennae. But also, the way the antlers develop is very interesting. I have a whole chapter in here on antlers, and what I've done there is I've drawn a parallel between the way antlers develop physically, and I've drawn that parallel to our own creative and also spiritual development, because the antlers are shed every year, and so they're a symbol from that viewpoint of death and renewal. And what happens with the antlers is they then go into the ground, and if they're left in the ground, they nourish the ground, they give the ground minerals, and then which then supplies nutrients for the plants that come up, and then the reindeer eat plants, you know. So it's like a recycling kind of process when the antlers are allowed to shed naturally. And then the reindeer, and this is true as well of all deer antlers, the deer have these little pedicles, and then the antlers start to grow from the pedicles, and they're very soft in the beginning and very tender. And in order to be that tenderness to be protected, they're covered with velvet, and that's called the velvet stage of antler growth. And I thought this is very much like our own growth, because I think in the beginning of any growth process, whether it's a psychological growth, an emotional growth, even a physical growth, a creative growth, a spiritual growth, we start out that process as tender, very tender, because it's at our beginnings, and it needs softness like the velvet, you know, to have a kind of a soft touch, and we need to be very soft with it. And so there's that stage of our development. And then as the antlers continue their growth process, eventually they get hard, and the velvet starts to come off, and the antlers, and it starts to hang in these kind of bloody streams, and the reindeer and the deer scrape their heads on trees and stuff to get them off. And the bloody velvet strips hanging down reminded me of kind of like red streamers announcing, this is an image that came up for me, announcing a parade of transformation in a way. I saw this. And then the way that the deer scrape off the velvet finally when it's no longer needed reminded me of the way that we need to hone our own spiritual and creative development. We need to be able to scrape off what we can't use, so to speak, what's no longer necessary, what was at one time necessary, but is no longer necessary. And then finally, the antlers are out there in all their beauty and their glory and all their strength. And that reminded me of the stage where we then really need to show ourselves in that strength and shiningness of our being. Okay, and then and sometimes that's where people stop, both on the spiritual level and on the creative level. They're afraid to show that beauty that they have. So I thought the antlers, just the antlers themselves, are kind of a symbol for our whole creative process, an image for our creative process. And then I also learned that the antlers were donned by shamans in the Arctic, but even other shamans as well. And so that the shamans would be wearing antlers when they would go into their shamanic ceremonies. And so you'll see lots of pictures all over of shamans with antlers. And the antlers are regarded as this connection with the spiritual world, actually. And for the people in the Arctic, the shamans there actually ride the reindeer, the animal, the reindeer, as a spiritual messenger. They regard the reindeer as the animal that can carry them to the spirit world. The shaman, as you know, is a healer in a society that travels to another realm beyond our ego realm, brings healing and wisdom back from the spirit world to heal either a member of the community who is sick in whatever way, or the community itself, the whole community itself. So in the Arctic, the reindeer peoples actually ride the reindeer to this other world. So the reindeer is a kind of a messenger between the two worlds. And it's a messenger in many different ways. Maybe you remember the fairy tale, The Snow Queen, by Hans Christian Andersen. That's probably a lot of you remember it, actually. And I think it's a story my grandmother used to tell me. And if you remember, though, the Ice Queen has captured a young boy by kind of putting a splinter of ice gets into his heart and one gets into his eye. And he begins to see everything cynically and meanly, whereas before he had been this open, loving young boy. And he had a friend whose name was Gerda, and his name was Kay. Well, he starts to treat Gerda poorly at that point. And then one day, the Ice Queen really takes him captive and takes him hostage up into her realm, the Ice Realm. Okay, and everybody, however, back on Earth thinks that she's dead. I mean, he's dead, rather. Kay is dead. But Gerda believes he's not dead. Gerda thinks that he's alive. She has belief in that. And so she sets out on a journey to try to find him. And when she reaches a certain point, she meets a girl. In the fairy tale, it's the robber girl, who's kind of a shadow figure for Gerda. And the robber girl has this reindeer that she has been actually teasing. But when she hears Gerda's story, she feels like she wants to help her, so she gives Gerda the reindeer to ride. Because the reindeer is the only animal that can make it up to the realm of the Ice Queen. And so Gerda gets on the reindeer, and the reindeer stops at two houses on the way. And they're women's houses. The reindeer stops at the house of a woman who gives Gerda some food and some physical nurturing, so it's kind of like a positive nurturing physical mother. And then she stops at another house where there's a woman who lives in a chimney and is all sooty and looks kind of dirty, but that woman has a spiritual connection and wisdom, and she gives Gerda some spiritual wisdom and whispers into the reindeer's ear that he must remind Gerda that she has the power within herself to deal with the Ice Queen, but she has to find that out by herself. So the reindeer takes Gerda to the corner, the borders of the Ice Kingdom, and tells Gerda to go on her way herself so that she will discover her own power. And Gerda gets off, and she enters the kingdom, and then she sees Kay and runs up to him and hugs him. And when she hugs him, her tears also fall on his heart, and that dislodges her hug, and the tears dislodge the ice in his heart. And then he cries, and that dislodges the ice in his eye. And so he's healed from the spell of the Ice Queen through the tears and through the love, and which connects with the reindeer tears. I'll tell you that later. And then they come back and get on the reindeer, who carries them back to their home. So that's a reindeer story. So there in that fairy tale, we have the same image of the reindeer as the animal who carries people for healing, really, to another world, and who can come back, who can traverse the two worlds, the world of the earth and the world of the spirit, okay? And so in many cultures then, particularly these northern cultures, the reindeer is really connected with healing. And I discovered then, I went around the country and also even in Europe giving workshops. Maybe I gave one here, I can't remember. I think I probably did on the reindeer woman or something. I don't know what I called it at the time. And I collected, people would volunteer different dreams about and experiences about deer and reindeer and so forth. And I learned that a lot of people actually have the reindeer image as a healing image for them. Modern day people have this image as a healing image. And so one man, for example, told me that when he was a little boy, he had to leave his mom and go to the hospital. And he was afraid, but he brought up the image of the reindeer because that was a comforting creature to him right before he went under the, you know, was given the anesthetic. And And he came through the operation, and he said that even to this day, and he was in his late 40s, he still uses this reindeer image as a healing image. And then I met a woman named Suzanne Lovell, who's she's a therapist, art therapist, and movement therapist. And she was diagnosed with cancer. And she did a kind of a spontaneous movement, because she's a movement therapist, and found herself dancing around a pole, and her arms were going around, and they were kind of like antlers. And then she had a dream where a woman wearing antlers came to her and gave her some healing wisdom. And she painted that image of this woman with antlers and quite a few times, and then that helped her. That was part of her healing through the process of cancer. She's done a video, actually, of this. But she didn't know that about this reindeer image where the females had antlers, nor did she know that the reindeer was an animal of healing for these Arctic cultures. So I thought that was really interesting. And then in Czechoslovakia, when I was in Prague, a woman came up. I gave a talk there on this, and a woman from Prague came up and said that she used to keep the image of the reindeer with her. She grew up, you know, in communism, as an image of riding to freedom, because she was trapped in this communist country, and the reindeer image. Her mother had told her a lot of reindeer stories when she was a little girl. And this image of the reindeer that could travel across borders was very helpful to her being trapped, caged, you might say, in a country where you weren't allowed to travel at all, get beyond any borders. So for her, too, it was an image. And for her, it was really important that the females had antlers because she was a kind of a gentle soul, and it gave her an image also at the same time that she could have for her own strength and for her protection. Can you follow all this or kind of connect with it? So all of this was really intriguing to me. And I also learned that the deer in general is connected with the heart and with compassion. So, for example, in a lot of different cultures, and so the Buddha, when he gave his sermon on compassion and mercy, he gave that sermon in the deer park in Benares, and he was surrounded by deer when he gave it. And in Buddhist iconography, there's a lot of deer. And in fact, there's one, people will share, deer and reindeer images with me. And a woman at Naropa, which is a Buddhist kind of oriented school, who taught and is a specialist in tantras, showed me a famous old tantra painting where there's a woman, Bodhisattva. She's a goddess of wisdom, and she rides a white reindeer. That's the center of the tanka. It's a tanka, and then she's surrounded by seven sisters, also Bodhisattvas on reindeer. So I thought that was really a beautiful image. And then Christ is a deer. Many times in legend, Christ is connected with compassion, of course, and so there are a lot of legends where a hunter is in a forest, and the hunter's hunting a deer, and all of a sudden the deer disappears in the mist, and when the mist clears, then there's Christ standing as Christ on a rock, and the hunter is amazed and puts down his gun, doesn't shoot the deer, and then Christ says, you know, come to me or something, and the person's converted, and then Christ turns back into a deer. And Saint Hubertus is an example. That's one example. And also Placidus is another example. And there's also the imagery of the deer's antlers with the sun in the center and a cross in the Scandinavian countries. Maybe some of you have seen that. The deer connects with the heart also for the Native American peoples, many of the Native American peoples, the Lakota people and the Pueblo people, see the deer as connected with the heart and with gentleness. There's a very beautiful novel written by a Pueblo Native American author named Frank Waters called The Man Who Killed the Deer. And it's about it's just an incredibly beautiful novel. And it's about a Pueblo man who's torn between his culture and the white culture, who kills a deer out of hunting season for the Americans, is sentenced to a jail sentence and a fine for doing that. But for his tribe, it's actually a more serious matter because he's killed the deer without the proper ceremonies and without asking the deer for its permission to be killed. And therefore, he's violated the law of all life, that everything is one and that one needs reverence and respect for life. And so this man is then sentenced by the tribal council, but he is haunted in his dreams by deer. And the deer, I won't go into this in great detail, but the deer start to, when he's making love with his wife one night, he hears deer hooves on the top of the house, and he can't make love anymore. And then he and his wife grow apart, and he finally has to come to terms with this deer that he's killed and understand that he killed the deer in the wrong way, and that the deer was part of a greater reality. So I have an analysis of that book of the man who killed the deer in this book, along with the yearling, which is another story about how a young boy's relationship to a deer changes his whole life. So I saw the deer then as connecting with the heart. Also, the Huichol Indians in Mexico, they feel the deer knows the secrets of the heart, and that's also their shamanic guide. So the deer connects with the heart, with compassion, and with healing. And then the reindeer in particular connects, and if somebody dies in folklore, it was said that you could take the liver of the deer and it would heal the wound.
Who was it in New Mexico?
Oh, the Huichol people. It's Huichol. You know, they actually take peyote to do their journeys, and the deer, they connect with peyote. They do the certain kinds of yarn kinds of paintings. So anyway, the deer is connected with healing and with the heart. And in the Arctic people, I found that almost all of the Arctic peoples have a reindeer goddess. And I thought that was really fascinating, that they have a reindeer goddess that's a mother creatrix goddess. And so you find that among the Sami people, and you also find that among the Siberian peoples, where there are about 8 or 9 different tribes of people in Siberia that revere the reindeer and live around the reindeer. So you've got an actual reindeer goddess from ancient times. And then the Eastern Slavic people also had a reindeer goddess called Rosanitsa. And she was also the goddess of the winter solstice, and they would worship her at the winter solstice. And she was the goddess who gave birth not only to reindeer, but also to baby humans. To humans. So it's a birthing goddess. The reindeer is also a birthing goddess. Healing, and then the heart and compassion. But in the case of the reindeer, it's also combined with an incredible strength and endurance and tenacity that enables them to make this very arduous journey about a month and a half for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles across all these different kinds of terrain in order to give birth. And they have these hooves, and now I'm going, and I have I talk about all this in the book, but they have these special hooves that spread out and contract according to the lay of the land, so to speak, because how many people here have been in the Arctic? A few people. So you know that there's a lot of marsh and bog, and there are these things called tussocks that are kind of rounded clumps that are very hard to walk on. And if you manage to get on one of those, then your next step is probably going to be into a bog. And so you have to really be able to go through this very difficult terrain. And then, of course, there's ice and snow and rivers and all of that kind of stuff. So the reindeer's hooves expand and contract according to what they need in order to get across all these different conditions of the earth. And they also have this extra thing called a dew claw that comes down and gives them an extra foot, kind of. And then they have something in their hoof as well that helps them get across ice, because they have to travel across a fair amount of ice. So it's as though their feet give them kind of expanded standpoints that are adaptable to all this different terrain. And I thought that's a wonderful image for us because we have to go across all different kinds of terrains on our own transformational journeys. So I really liked that image. And then they also have something called, or they have these hairs that are hollow. And the hollow hairs trap the air, and the air works as an insulator, and that keeps them warm through the most severe conditions, and also it helps them keep buoyant when they're making the river crossings. And I thought that's something we also could use as an image, because we need buoyancy when we're crossing the rivers of our life, so to speak, depressive rivers and so forth. And we also need something to keep ourselves warm, images to help us keep warm when we're in icy and cold times. So these are just physical facts about the reindeer, which I thought were absolutely fascinating, that connect with our own individual spiritual journeys. And then the fact that the reindeer have this incredible endurance and survival and tenacity when they make their journey. So, and then I thought it's really fascinating that the people, you know, who live with the reindeer revere the reindeer as a holy animal, and they follow the reindeer, and they also, however, have to live from the reindeer, right? Because the reindeer is part of what they live from. And so they have to live in a certain kind of a paradox that I feel exemplifies in the extreme, the paradox that all humans have to live in, that paradox between living in the practical world where we need to survive, and but without losing contact with the world, the mysterious world that's greater than us. And so they both revere the animal as holy on the one hand, and but they have a practical relationship to it too. And they live within this paradox, and their stories, say about hunting and so forth, show the necessity of living in this kind of a paradox. So I thought that was absolutely fascinating. Then I took three different trips. I first went to Lapland, okay, and learned about the Sami culture, and I learned a lot of gathered a lot of myths and stories and so forth. And I learned that the when the Protestants came in 1700, they tried to convert the Samis, and they forbid their practices, and they took away their magic drums, and which the shamans would use to go into a trance. I think the Samis were able to save one or two of them, but most of them were taken away and put in the basement of a cathedral, which then accidentally burned down, and so they were all destroyed. And so there was a kind of a patriarchal system, I guess you could call it, that was really destructive of this kind of reverential way of life that honors nature and the shamanic mode. And then I learned when I was in Siberia that the Soviets went even further. They tried literally to kill all the shamans in Siberia. So a totally different system, another kind of patriarchal system though, tried to destroy the practices of those cultures by killing the shamans. And however, the group of people that I was with, and their name is the Even people, it's a tribe, and remember there are about 8 or 9 of these tribes up in Siberia, they were still actually living a shamanic life, though their shamans had been killed as far as they knew. And they shared with me a little bit about their life, and I'd like to share a little bit about that with you too, because it's really fascinating. And actually, to me, it was a great gift and a miracle to be able to reach these people, because I tried this in 1992, and I had already been to Lapland. I had gone also to Alaska to look at the caribou, because the caribou are American relatives of the reindeer, and the caribou people. And then I wanted to go to Siberia, and which anyway had been, being a nomad, had been a lifelong dream as a child. But the question was how to get there, you know. And in 1986, after Keith's dream, but before I started on the book, that's something important I forgot to mention, we did go to Russia, not to Siberia, And when we went, we were detained in South Central Asia. And we wanted to uncover the soul of Dostoevsky. But actually, the way we got there was on a trip with psychiatrists to study the borderline personality. So that was our excuse. But anyway, we were all detained in South Central Russia, and we weren't told why. And then we were allowed finally to go to Leningrad, which was where Keith and I wanted to go, because that's where Dostoevsky spent most of the rest of his adult life after he came back from Siberia. You know, he was sent to prison in Siberia, and then he came back, and where he wrote Crime and Punishment and Brothers Karamazov and so forth. So we finally got back to Leningrad, and we were able to go to Dostoevsky's house and so forth, but we felt something ominous in the air. We didn't know what it was. And we got to the airport, and then we were told that we had to be checked for radiation. And we learned we were detained because Chernobyl happened. So now, you know, the fallout from Chernobyl went up into the Arctic, went up through Lapland and into the Arctic, affected the reindeer, and many reindeer were slaughtered because they were afraid that the reindeer meat would be sold with the radiation. So that the reindeer were somehow in my psyche, but not too consciously yet, but a little bit connected with this travesty, this ecological travesty. And at the time, in Witness to the Fire, I was writing about addiction and creativity, but I had a chapter called The World's Night, which is about the dark night of the soul of the world, okay, which has to do with the place that we've gotten into ecologically because of our addiction to power. And I began to see there was maybe a connection between the reindeer and this global devastation, but it was very intuitive. So anyway, I made a little side reindeer journey there. On the way to Siberia to try to get there was very difficult because in 1992 everything was crumbling in Russia, and I thought, I called the travel agency. I was going to Prague and, you know, to the transpersonal conference, and I had a lecture I was doing in Moscow, and I called the different travel agencies and asked them if they could help me get up to see reindeer people. And they said, reindeer people? You know, you want to see reindeer people in Siberia? Forget it. We can get you to Siberia, but reindeer people, no. But I had read the Lonely Planet travel guide for the poor and independent traveler, and it said that there were such thing as reindeer people and that one could get to some place. And so I thought if I could even just get to a little teeny-weeny taste of reindeer people, that would be enough. So I didn't give up. And I mentioned that I wanted to do this to a friend of mine named Betty Metter. Perhaps she's lectured here. She's a Jungian analyst in San Francisco. And she said, well, actually, my brother-in-law has a Siberian woman staying with him. Why don't you call her? The synchronicity again. So I did. And she said, well, my husband has just become a travel agent now that Russia has opened up. And he had been a scientist. He was a geneticist, actually. And he decided to start a travel agency. He was gearing it, actually, to psychologists. And he brought some psychologists over to Lake Baikal. So we got in touch with him and told him what we wanted to do. And he sent out his staff, who were all scientists, and they knew how to research things. And then, also synchronistically, I was lecturing at Pacifica Graduate School when a woman walked off the street to ask about the school, and she talked to the dean who had been in Siberia on a kind of a tour, and he knew I wanted to go, and she said she'd heard there was a shaman conference being held in Siberia that summer. And he located that where the shaman conference was, got me permission to go, because you needed permission, of course, at that time to travel in Russia, and he tracked from the shaman conference, he tracked a member of the tribe that we later visited. And so we had this possibility of going. But then when we got to Russia, what we found out is that whenever you went to take a plane any place, they canceled the plane, and you couldn't get anywhere. And so, and then you'd have to wait for maybe, you know, like 32 hours or something on the floor in the airport, or in hopes that somebody would be able to bribe you know, and get you a seat. So this happened about 3 or 4 times, and we had to go through all these different convoluted routes. And when finally, and we were thinking, you know, we're just never going to get there. But somehow we did end up at this place called Yakutsk, which was where the shaman conference was to be held, and where we were to meet up with some kind of a helicopter, the cargo helicopter that would get us there. And we got there a day late. The helicopter was supposed to have left, but it was there somehow. And so we got on the helicopter and sat on some sacks of potatoes with some native peoples and rode about 3 hours. And then the helicopter swooped down among the mountain ranges, landed in a kind of a partially dry riverbed, and we got out. And we had an interpreter and a guide. And we stayed there a few days. The people came running down the hill with some reindeer meat, I guess, for the helicopter pilots. The helicopter flew off, and we looked and wondered, you know, will it come back? But anyway, there we were. And so then the people told us to come up to this meadow, and where we were greeted by the tribe and the elder, and 1,300 reindeer were coming running towards us. And that was really thrilling, to see all these reindeer come running towards us in who knows where we were, somewhere near the Arctic Circle, around the Lena River someplace. It was just fantastic. And they then shared their living mythology with us, and which I recount in the book also. And basically, they told us that they believed they were created to care for the reindeer and to ride the reindeer. They actually ride the reindeer. And when they're riding the reindeer, they feel they are, at the same time as they're riding on the physical level, they feel they're riding to the spirit world. And they ride with the pole, and the pole for them is the world pole that unites the upper world, the spirit world, with the earth world, with the mid world. This is in shamanism is a traditional concept. So that the pole gives them a physical balance when they ride the reindeer, and at the same time it gives them a supernatural balance of transcendental, I would say, centering. And this is their life. Their life is to be with the reindeer, to care for the reindeer, to ride the reindeer. And when they die, their bodies are placed in the branches of trees, and the tree branches for them are like the reindeer antlers. And if you see a lot of reindeer antlers, you'll see that the antlers look a lot like branches. And there are many, many Sami poems that kind of make parallels between the antlers and the tree branches. And then the antlers of they each have a special spirit reindeer too, are put there with their bodies. And then when they die, they're taken to the other world, to the spirit world, where they ride on earth as they do, in the spirit world as they do on earth. And so that's their life. And they have all sorts of ceremonies. They have a kind of a big round dance to celebrate the summer solstice and the birth of the baby reindeers. And they told us all about that. And when Keith told them his dream, at one point he told them his dream, they asked why we were there, because they'd only had two other visitors before. They had one French and one German hunter that came together and stayed a day because they're a hunting tribe, and a BBC crew. And we were their only other visitors from the outside world. And so they were very eager to share their life with us. Anyway, Keith told them his dream, and they said, "Oh yes, we know that reindeer woman. She's our goddess Kinkin." And I asked them what that name meant, and they said it meant without stress, which I thought was really interesting. And so she's a goddess of healing and hunting. But when when that figure appears in one of their dreams, they know that she said it's okay to go out hunting. So, but they didn't tell us that. Then, but anyway, that night they went out hunting, and they brought back 3 heads of bighorn sheep. And when I got up in the morning, I saw these severed heads of bighorn sheep by the fire. And I've always been opposed to hunting, so I really had to deal with that paradox, because here I was with the hunting tribe. The people were beautiful and loving and gentle, and I saw that it was an organic part of their life, and so it made sense to me. And then they told us, yes, that she, when she appears in a dream, they go out hunting and they know it's all right. And they said that they rode the reindeer to a certain place and the reindeer stopped. This is what they said. And the reindeer said they had to wait until the animals came up to them to be caught. And then when they did that, then they could catch a certain number of the animals. And the reindeer gave them the sign. And they did, and then they brought the animals back. And then they gave thanks for that giving. And they have a tradition in their society. I have a lot of Siberian stories and stories from the Arctic in here also. And some of those stories are actually about how, you know, living in nature and living with animals and hunting. And they have a tradition of sharing that they call Nemet. And so one of their first most important ethical principles is to share whatever they have with the whole community. And so I think when Keith shared his dream, then that was for them like a dream. They took it as we would say an archetypal dream, right? But they took it as a dream that had meaning for them. And then they shared their mythology with us, and they also shared their everything that they ate with us. And the way they did that was, and this is an ecological way that they, just an example of one of the many things they do, they would take a little rib of meat and a knife and they pass it around in a circle. And you just take off a little slice, whatever you felt you wanted, and then you'd pass it to the next person. And then if you were still hungry, it came around again and you could take some more. But if you weren't hungry, then you wouldn't eat it, right? And whereas we'd been going around in Russia and we were just given all this food in hotels and everything, and there's starving people out on the streets, you know, and we were just, you know, wasting all this food, that we just felt terrible about it, you know. So I thought this was a way that they had of living. And they also milked. I need to check my time here, I guess. Do I? Huh?
You're about your hour time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay, good. So what I'm going to do is talk for about 5 or 10 minutes, then we'll have a break, and so forth. So they milk the reindeer, the milk from the reindeer dough, which they regard as holy. And that reminded me that when I was a little girl, I grew up in a big city. I've recounted this in the book too, but I grew up in a big city, and I grew up in my family was poor because my father couldn't work, and my mother was supporting the family at minimum wages and everything, and there wasn't any nature there. There weren't any animals except for this milk horse that drew the milk. This is a while ago. So I would, and this milk horse name was Dolly, and it came every Saturday, and I would follow Dolly around her route, her milk route, and give her, like, you know, little pieces of apples and stuff and pats. And then she would get to a place where my mom said I couldn't pass. It would be into a dangerous neighborhood, or what she said was a dangerous neighborhood. And then I couldn't go any further, but then I'd wait next week until Dolly would come. And I thought, well, for me was a direct parallel of following that milk horse, as she became kind of my spirit guide. And, you know, really helped me with hope when I would, you know, be in despair, because I grew up in this traumatic family setting. And here was this people far away who had this tradition of the holy milk from the reindeer udders. And so I really saw it brought me back to my own childhood and how important animals are. I talk a lot about that in this book, too, how important animals are for us. To teach us lessons of caring. And all these reindeer cultures, their whole life is really around caring. And central then is that the reindeer symbolizes the mystery of existence, and they believe they were put on earth to care for the reindeer through revering it. So what I would like to end with is this part, is a creation story that I feel expresses a lot of the feeling of what the reindeer are about. But before that, I do want to mention a poem by W.H. Auden that just came into my mind, which is about hope. And in his poem, The Fall of Rome, perhaps you've read that poem, he talks about the decline of Western civilization and the despair that we're in, and how we make these vain attempts to mutiny, rebel, or adapt, but they don't work for us. And then in the last four lines of the poem, suddenly he jumps to reindeer. He jumps from the decline of Rome to reindeer. And he says, somewhere elsewhere, vast, the reindeer are out in this wilderness roaming very fast and silently over the golden moss. And so he brings the reindeer in as an image of hope, which is what I discovered the reindeer were for these cultures and for individuals living here, even in America and in Europe. And I had also forgotten to mention that many women were painting reindeer antlers on their head. And I also, I'm just going to not tie this in right now, but I'm going to throw out that I uncovered a theme of the wounded deer in people's dreams. And Frida Kahlo, you know, painted herself as a wounded deer, the Mexican artist. She has her face, deer's body, antlers, arrows are going into her body. And that symbolized for her her wounding from both physical and relational from Diego Rivera, but also her healing, because she had actually a pet fawn that she loved, and that symbolized healing for her. But anyway, so the wounded deer, I thought, well, we're all like wounded deer in a culture that isn't peaceful. Okay? But the hope are in the reindeer and the deer. This is the way my psyche was going. Okay, so here's the creation story. this is a creation story from the Sami Swedish part of the world. Okay, Swedish part of the Sami culture. And in this story, the creator is walking along the great waters. And the creator is valuing peace and love and harmony. But that's suddenly is interrupted by shrieks of hatred and mocking cries of hatred and distrust and meanness. And he's disturbed by this, as that's all coming from the netherworld. And he says, what's happened that such a world has come to be where we have hatred? He thinks, well, I must create the world anew, but from what and how? And then what comes into his imagination is the image of his favorite being, which is a reindeer doe. The name for that is Vaja in the Swedish language. And also for the Siberians, they call the reindeer doe Vaja. So he calls the Vaja over to him, and she comes running across the holy mountain of Pasivari, and her hooves are sparkling, reflecting the sunlight. And she comes up in front of him, and he looks at her, and she's just so beautiful, and he looks into her deep, soft, tender eyes. You know how when you look into the eyes of a deer, they kind of draw you in? And so he says, he looks into her eyes and he says, from you, my dear, I'm going to make a new world, a world that's imbued with love and harmony. And he takes a bone from her body and uses it as a bridge to bridge the abyss between the upper world and the nether world. And then he takes her flesh, and that becomes the earth. And the rest of her bones become the spine of the earth and the mountain ridges and so forth. And then he takes her hair, and that becomes the grasses and the leaves on the trees. And then he takes her blood, and the blood become the rivers that flow. And he finally takes the skull of her head, and he puts that as a shield in the sky, to protect humans from the blazing lights of the divine. And then he takes her eyes, which become the morning and the evening stars that guide the poets, the dreamers, the lovers, and the lost wanderers. And finally, he takes her still beating heart and he puts her heart into the very center of the earth. And he says that her heartbeat will be the beat of the earth. And so that when the earth, and it will show whether the earth is living, whether the peoples on earth are living in love and harmony. And when that's happening, the doe's heart will beat with love and joy. And people will be able to hear that. He puts the treasures, all the treasures of the universe, around her heart as well. But when the world, and if the world becomes torn asunder, as it did when he was walking there along the eternal waters and he heard the cries of hatred, then the reindeer doe's heart will beat with pain and will heave, and there'll be tremors in the earth. And that's how we'll know that things aren't right. And so he then tells the people that what they need to do is to learn to listen to the heartbeat of the reindeer doe buried deep in the earth and follow that heartbeat, and that will keep them living in peace. And it will be there also, even in times of dread, as a sign of hope, even when times are dark. So that's the story, and that's where the title came from. Okay, so now we'll take a break. I'll be happy to sign your books if you would like me to do that. I can sign them in the break, and I can sign them afterwards, though I guess we have to be out of here by 9:30. Maybe take a 15, 20-minute break or so, and then we can come back, and you can ask me whatever you would like, or we'll do whatever you want me to do within reason.
We should have some questions and answers. What do you want to do? The drawing is at the very end? Is that...
Yeah, the drawing is at the very end.
Yeah, okay. So you'll signal me when that is. Okay. Anybody have anything that questions? It's 9:05 or something like that. Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit to Santa and his reindeer?
Thanks. I was intending to do that, actually, but... I forgot.
Could you repeat the questions?
Oh, yes.
The tape, huh? Mm-hmm. There we go. Okay.
Could I speak? Is it on?
Yes.
Okay. Could I speak to Santa and his reindeer? I was planning to do that, actually, but I have so much to talk about, in a way, with respect to the reindeer that I can never get it all in. Anyway... my view of this is that the shamanic cultures see the reindeer as the animals that they ride through the sky, actually, to the spirit world, from the earth to the spirit world. And so I think that the reindeer came in to the Santa story from the shamanic cultures, and I see... And Santa, of course, lives in the North Pole, takes care of the reindeer. I see Santa as a shaman... Because, shamans go down through, one of the ways they go between the worlds is through the chimneys. And in the story, that's what he does. And I see the reindeer, then, as bringers of spiritual gifts of transformation, as opposed to the material gifts that have come to take their place in our materialistic culture. And somebody pointed out to me, actually a guy from a Asami background in Eugene, pointed out to me about the elves, because actually the Asami people are kind of small, and he said maybe that the elves kind of connect, they're Santa's helpers, they kind of connect with the Asami people themselves. So I feel the reindeer are... And I read a book about the Santa Claus story, just to check up on this. It was a kind of an academic book, and they said that the reindeer are a kind of extraneous insertion into the story. But I think, of course, how many people know about shamanism? And how many people know about the Arctic shamanism in particular and the symbolism of the reindeer? So that's what I see. So I think the reindeer are really important, and then the reindeer goddess... is the goddess of the winter solstice too, which has to do, you know, and that's the time, which is kind of interesting, that's the time of year when the days have been at their longest and then become, they start to get shorter, right? So, and the reindeer I see as kind of, I think maybe I didn't mention this, as totem animals of the mystics, and because they live in the dark nights, you know, because you've got the dark nights there for part of the year, and then you've got the light nights, and they can live through both of those extremes. So I see them as very mystical animals in general, and then that's my connection with them for the Santa story. Thanks for asking the question.
In Greek cultures, I keep thinking of Iphigenia, and when
Agamemnon
and the sacred deer were slaughtered, they would be calm.
Right.
There has to be a
right. Right. She's asking or mentioning or bringing up, I should say, at the story of Iphigenia. Yeah. Maybe it's Genia, probably. And Agamemnon. I have that story in this book. Yes, I do. I also have it in The Wounded Woman. I've talked about it in The Wounded Woman as an example of the father-daughter sacrifice, and I reintroduced it here in the chapter on the wounded deer, which I just barely mentioned in my talk. But because I think, and so thanks for bringing it up, if you remember that Iphigenia is the eldest daughter of Agamemnon, and he's the king of Greece, and he's coming from the house of Atreus, okay? And so the Greeks won a war on Troy, and one of the reasons that they give for the war is because Helen, who's the wife of Agamemnon's brother Menelaus, was stolen by the Trojans. So that's the overt reason, they say, for going to war. But the winds stop blowing, right? And so they can't go to war. And Agamemnon consults the oracle, and he's told that he has to sacrifice his eldest daughter, Iphigenia, to Artemis, okay, the goddess Artemis, who's goddess of the deer and of the hunt and of the woods. Now, in the story, in the legends around the story of Iphigenia and Agamemnon, there's the play by Euripides, okay, but in the legends, it was said that Agamemnon had entered, prior to this, had entered Artemis's holy forest, and that he shot one of her sacred deer. And there's a beautiful film called Iphigenia, a Greek film, by some people have seen it. It's just incredible, called Kakaianos, and it opens with this scene of this incredible, beautiful deer with golden horns going through the mist in this forest, and then Agamemnon in pursuit, and he kills the deer. So there you've got the image of the wounded deer. Moreover, he bragged that he was a better hunter than Artemis herself. And these two things really angered Artemis, so she stopped the winds. Anyway, he then doesn't want to sacrifice his oldest daughter because he loves her, and she's very deer-like. She's very gentle and very graceful and just kind of like a deer in the film. She kind of looks like a deer almost. And but he doesn't know what to do because the men are going to revolt. And so he, on a pretext, he gets her to come and says she's going to be wedded to, was it Achilles? Achilles, right, okay. Now, then the mother, Clytemnestra, is suspicious. She wonders why she was, but he tells her, his wife, Clytemnestra, to stay home. And Clytemnestra says, no way, I'm going with my daughter to her wedding. So she comes against his orders. And then what happens is that Clytemnestra begins to realize that Iphigenia is going to be sacrificed, and she confronts Agamemnon, and she says, if you do this, you'll get my revenge. She says, I was married to you by my father out of duty, and I've lived with you, but, you know, this, enough is enough. But anyway, Agamemnon, afraid to go against the men, sacrifices Iphigenia. That is, Iphigenia is led up to the sacrificial altar, and then we don't know what happens to her. Actually, the mist comes over and you don't see. And as it turns out, Iphigenia is then taken by Artemis to be a priestess in her temple on the island of Taurus. And there's another play called Iphigenia and Taurus. But then because Agamemnon has killed Iphigenia, symbolica, I think, of this deer, the gentle deer. She's now the wounded deer, right? The mad woman, who I hadn't mentioned before, but who actually interrupted my reindeer book and demanded to be written, comes out in Clytemnestra. And she gets so angry that she plots the murder of Agamemnon, and she takes a lover, and she has her lover kill Agamemnon. And then her daughter, Electra, of the Electra, famous Electra complex of Freud, gets angry at her mother for killing her father, and she has her brother Orestes kill Clytemnestra, right? So you've got the father killing the daughter, the mother killing the husband, the daughter killing the father, and then Orestes goes mad. And then he's brought to trial, and the Furies want to kill him, but Athena intervenes and takes him to the island of Taurus, where then he's met by, in a later play, by Iphigenia, who's now a priestess to Artemis. But you see, like, how the whole kind of tragedy is carried on down through the different family members with this wounding of the deer-like quality, and the going to war is a wounding of that deer-like quality. So, so I talk about that in the book. And I also talk about the Deer Hunter movie. You remember that movie from Vietnam? That's a really incredible film, and I saw it, you know, again several times, and it's about the war, and it's about these three guys who, you know, who go to Vietnam, but one of the three, who's played by Robert De Niro, has a wonderful connection with nature and with the deer and even with the indigenous cultures, and he goes deer hunting with some other men who, you know, they're ill-prepared, they don't know anything about hunting, and they disregard all the good ethical hunting rules that there are. And he says, you know, never wound a deer. You have to take a deer with one shot if you're going to kill it. And so before the war, he goes on the hunting trip and does kill a deer. Then they think they're going to be heroes. They go to Vietnam. And, of course, then they're confronted with the horrors that are going on in Vietnam. And they're taken as a hostage, and they're tortured. And of the three, one becomes a paraplegic, one becomes mad, and Robert De Niro manages to save, you know, the paraplegic, and he becomes a hero. And so when he comes home, the people in his town want to hold a hero party for him, but he can't. He doesn't want that because he thinks the war is so horrible. For him, being in the war was not to be a hero at all. It was to participate in a travesty. So he doesn't go to the party, and he goes out hunting again. He goes back and he tries to save the guy. One guy stayed behind, the guy who went mad. He tries to save him. He can't. And then he goes back hunting again, and there's a scene where he leaves the other men, and do you remember this scene? It's really beautiful, and he meets a deer, and he looks in the deer's eyes, and the deer looks in his eyes, and he realizes he could never kill another deer, and so he lets the deer go, and he shoots the gun up in the air, and then he goes back, and he tells everybody that when they asked him where the deer is that he missed. But he lets the deer go. And so I think that film is really about the wounded deer and his learning to be, you know, I mean, he always was compassionate, but even at a great deeper level to be compassionate and about the war and the heart. Anyway, I talk about it in the book. So, yeah.
You're talking a little bit before about the connection of the deer and the sky. And the image of the tree, and you know, you can see almost the deer as the reindeer as a combination of tree and deer. But yeah. The other side of it, which talked a little bit about, is going into the night. An animal that is able to almost go into the unconscious and come out.
That's
walk
right.
Walk where humans cannot walk. Go into the night. Live where people cannot live. And come back out again.
That's right. Yeah. So just to repeat your question as you asked me to do, it's not a question, it's a comment, that the deer can go into the night, dwell in the night, and lead us into the night, or the unconscious. And I think that the deer is a symbol for that. And there, I've a lot of people have told me dreams where, or experiences even, where they meet a deer, a real deer, and many dreams of where a deer will come and bid them to follow it. And then they're, by following it, they go into the unconscious. So the deer is actually a spirit guide in that way. And there's, I have a lot of different fairy tales in here. Not, and a lot of them are from the Arctic, but not all. And one is called The Enchanted Deer. It's an Irish tale. And in it, there's a guy who goes to hunt a deer. And he's not really a hunter, but somebody asks him to kill a deer, actually. And when he aims, suddenly the deer becomes a woman. And he realizes that he doesn't shoot. And then it becomes a deer again. And then he wonders if he, you know, saw anything. And then he takes his gun up again, but it, the deer becomes a woman again. So at this point, he puts down the gun and he follows the deer. And so it's like the, to me, it's the mystical feminine leading him to the mystical feminine. And in the story, he goes on a journey following her, and he, you know, he goes through all these different tests and trials that are part of his growth and so forth. And in the end, she is in a kingdom under the sea, and he goes to that kingdom. So I think I see that as a symbol of the mystical feminine being, you know, deep in the unconscious, and he goes down there and is able to retrieve her, so to speak. So I don't know if that's where you were going.
That's wonderful, thank you.
Yeah, but thanks for bringing that up. Because see, there's so much about the deer, it's just incredible. Well, you know, so many different meanings and so forth that it has, and but that's a very important thing about the deer leading us into the unconscious. Yeah?
When you spoke the words in the creation tale of the creator speaking to the deer, you said, my deer.
Yeah, oh, right. Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if you have any knowledge on those.
Uh-huh. Well, etymologically, I haven't been able to find an etymological connection, but there may be. And I haven't done a real thorough etymological search of that relationship between the word D-E-A-R and the word D-E-E-R. But I do think, but it's a what would you call it, phonic? Or, huh? There's a word for that kind of, huh? Homophone, thank you. Connection, just between the way they sound, between the sounds. And I think, so that deer is, you know, that's an expression of the tenderness and the love and the caring of which the deer is. And there's another one between heart, H-E-A-R-T, and H-A-R-T, which is the word for deer. And the deer is a symbol for the heart in all these different cultures. So I think there's something to that. I did look up heart and heart night, but it was in an unsophisticated etymological thing. And but I'm going to try to get a better source if I can.
Mabish. My little fawn, their children.
Oh, they do?
It's a German endearment.
Oh, my little fawn. And what is, how do you say it again?
Mabish.
Mabish. Oh. Oh, and it means my little fawn. Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you see, it's a universal thing. And then Frida Kahlo had that pet fawn, you know, which is unusual. And she, for her, there was a connection with the Aztecs, actually, the Aztecs and the deer. So, yeah. And I will make a confession that when I lived in Switzerland, I was in Zurich training there, and my people nicknamed me Bambi. Because I was shy and afraid to face some of the Swiss, what shall I say, authoritative types. Yeah. Now, of course, the shadow of the deer would be the flight aspect. I mean, if we're going to look at this shit, because my editor asked me that, right? All right, you know, what's the dark side here of the deer? Well, that would be just only fleeing and not, you know, not standing up to And that's why I think the reindeer is nice, because the reindeer have the antlers that enables them to stand up. And another dark side would be the deer qualities, I think, appeal to the child in us, and they evoke trust and innocence, and which are wonderful qualities. But the shadow side of that would be so much innocence that you would be naive, right? Too naive and taken in and not be able to, again, to fight for yourself. And that's where the Mad Woman art book, I suppose, came in and demanded to be written as a... She wanted to have her voice in there. Yes?
You mentioned the reindeer going up to the place where they were born.
Mm-hmm.
Like Santa. Well, we didn't say Santa.
But it is, yeah.
But when Santa would die, what are the reindeer doing when they come after they have...
Oh, no... They don't die. They have their. They go up. They have their child, and the actually the mothers keep the previous baby with them for a whole year, so that when they're making the journey, they have a little baby. They're like the new that's just about a yearling. Okay, go up with them, and then they give birth, and they stay up there. They're always wandering around, and they're eating and so forth. And then they come back with their new baby, and by the time they get up there, the yearling is weaned and comes back on its own. So they make this journey every year.
So all families, in a sense, are born in the same place?
Pretty much, yeah. And the same with caribou. And so they have these migration paths that don't acknowledge, their paths don't accord with, like, national borders. You know, nor do they accord with the oil companies in Alaska. And that's why it's such a problem that the oil companies are trying to put down their stuff around and it's disturbing to the caribou's migration routes. You know, even in that Brooks, that incredible Brooks range. So that's the problem, you see. They're being interfered with, their migration routes. So they tend to take the same way, and then they kind of come back. And they just do that every year. So it's a cyclical kind of journey that I see as parallel to the journey of the seasons, that I see as parallel to our own journeys, our own spiritual, creative, and transformative journeys, because I think we have to come round and round on the same things. And but we go to deeper levels and we spread out and everything, but we have to keep coming back. So that would be a difference. Yeah, they don't die. I mean, some are killed, of course, on the journey. Some don't make it. They have to go across very difficult rivers. And actually, I learned, too, that an elder doe leads the pack across these river crossings, which I thought was kind of a neat image for women. Especially older women, as like myself now, which I didn't used to be. But it's happening. And I also, before I leave, I want to mention the film The Pathfinder, in case you don't know about it. It's a Sami film. It's a Norwegian Sami film, and it's on video. It was nominated for an Oscar about 5 years. Anybody here seen it?
What's
Pathfinder?
Yeah.
You saw it, yeah. So did you see it on video? Did you see it in the...
In the theater.
In the theater, yeah. Okay. Well, it's on video, and it's actually in a lot of video stores because it's there's a lot of action in it. But it's got subtitles, and so you'd find it in the foreign section. And it's about Sami life, but it's a feature film and an age-old legend about the reindeer and the Sami people. And it's a kind of a journey of this young boy who basically becomes a shaman. I almost said salmon. And right. And but what's interesting in the film is when it starts out, the shaman says, "I had a vision of the white reindeer three times in my life. When I was young, when I was your age," and the boy's 16, "and now." And now he's, I don't know how old he is, but he has a premonition that I think it's the end of his life. And then the next scene is a Sami family. A little girl and a boy, her dog are out playing, and the mother and the father are working. And these invaders come in, with all dressed in metal and black and, you know, big. And first they shoot. They take a, it's an arrow, bow arrow thing. They shoot the dog, then they shoot the little girl, and then they shoot the parents, and they dump them down a hole. And I think that's symbolic of the killing off of the instincts and the gentle feminine, you know, and then the whole family thing. And the boy comes over, he's been hunting, he comes back on his cross-country skis and hits the crest of a hill and stops and sees all this happening. And then he tries to escape to warn the other Sami people, and they shoot him, so they wound him. And then, but he reaches a settlement where he meets the shaman. And there's a scene where he's in total despair. He's given up on everything, you know, because he's seen his family killed. And the shaman says, "Do you believe in anything?" And he says, "No." And he says, "Well, do you see anything here besides me?" You know. And the boy says, "No, I can't see anything else." The shaman says, "You can't see anything?" And he says, "No." And then the shaman suddenly goes like this to the boy and cuts off his breath. And he holds the boy's breath until he, just to the last moment, so he can breathe. And then the boy takes a breath, and then he says, "And now, do you think that there's something else in the room?" And the boy says, "Yes, air." And the shaman says, "Yes." And just like the air is invisible, we too are surrounded by invisible presence. And the Sami people know that we're all related through what's greater than us, and we haven't broken the bonds of relationship. But these invaders, who are called Chudes, they believe in nothing greater than themselves, and they've cut off their relationship with one another. And so then the boy goes on. Then the Chudes come in, they kill the shaman, they take the boy hostage, and they try to get him to lead him to the other ones, and he goes on a journey, and he tricks them. And so he tricks them into cutting, he takes them over a mountain pass, and he tells them that he's the only one who knows the way, which is true, and they have to tie themselves up together because it's too dangerous, so they do that. And then he jumps off the side, so they start to fall off, and to save themselves, they cut the ropes that tie them together, proving the shaman was right. And then that sets off an avalanche. They're all done away with by nature. And then the boy goes on to the village down the mountain, and he looks up, and he sees this great white reindeer. And then he goes on. So that's I probably shouldn't have told you the story, but I feel a little guilty now. But it doesn't matter, because it's such an incredible film. It's so beautiful. So please see it. And I talk about the story in there too. It's a wonderful film, really inspiring film. So now it's time for the big drawing.
Copyright C.G. Jung Society of Seattle and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.